Welcome to Science Storytime. Today's topic, philanthropy with a social scientist.
So, welcome to Science Storytime. My name is Brandon, and today I'm talking with my friend Elise. Elise is pursuing her PhD at the University of Washington in the Department of Geography, and her work has been focusing on the interaction between poverty, community, and philanthropy. So she's been involved since the time that I've known her in something called the Social Justice Fund, which aims to promote social change through targeted grants, and is also working with the Relational Poverty Network, which is bringing together scholars to foster collaborators between, you know, poverty researchers. In the time that I've known Elise, she's shown herself to be one of the most kind and caring people I've ever met, who has a firm belief in the community-building power of food, which is a belief that I share very much as well, and a deep love of the city of Amsterdam. So, Elise, I am very happy to get a chance to chat with you and about your work and to hear what you've been up to lately.
Well, thanks, Brandon. I'm really excited to be able to chat. And that was a really, really nice introduction. Thank you.
Yeah. So I guess I wanted to start off by asking what your history was with philanthropy, how you sort of got involved with this field to begin with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thanks for that question. So...
You can always tell an academic when they respond, thanks for that question, or that's a really interesting thought.
My advisor has trained me well to never say, that's a great question.
It's all you hear people say. You finish a talk and you get something like, that's a great question.
Yeah, so that is no longer in my vocabulary.
That's
so
really good.
There you go. But it is a great question. So I have kind of two ways to answer that question. One is the very academic way, but that's less interesting to me. But I can circle back to that if you want.
Okay.
But I studied geography as an undergrad in college. I went to McAllister College in St. Paul, Minnesota, and didn't know geography was a discipline. But I stumbled into a class, and I'd always enjoyed school. I was a good student, but I got to my first geography class and just realized that, like, the way that geographers think about the world is the way that my brain already works.
Okay.
So it just, like, I didn't really know that. Like, school was always a lot of work for me. It was always, I was a good student, but it was hard. And so when I got to geography, it was like, oh, geographers are interested in the relationship between people and places. And so thinking about relationship across place, relationship across scale, thinking about how one thing that happens here influences this and that really appealed to me. And so throughout college and then after college, I only really ever worked for nonprofits because they seemed to align with my values. I was at a really hippy-dippy liberal arts school that definitely sent a lot of people to work to nonprofits.
Yeah.
And it raised a lot of questions for me. And I got really interested in kind of the political economy of nonprofits, why organizations functioned the way they did. And then at some point realized that what I was really interested in was what was going on with the donors kind of behind the scenes. Like, how were organizations telling stories about the work they did?
Okay.
To donors? Like, how were they getting people on board? What did that mean for the recipients of nonprofit services? You know, were they being like tokenized as, here's this needy person, give us your money? Was it pulling at the heartstrings? Was it a little bit more transactional? Or was it actually kind of based in like a deep connection and relationship, which is quite rare, is what I'm finding. So I found myself interested in philanthropy kind of accidentally, where I had always worked for nonprofit sectors, and just because of my exposure to geography and thinking about the relationship between people and places, I was like, oh, well, the donors are somewhat and surprisingly absent from the nonprofit. You know, like, they're both deeply reliant on it, and they were kind of invisible to the day-to-day interactions. And so I started getting interested in, like, what's going on behind the scenes, what types of interactions are happening that make this work possible.
So then what does your work actually look like? Is it trying to examine that portion of the relationship between the nonprofit and the donor?
Kind of, yeah. So my work in philanthropy then, when I started actually concentrating on it for my dissertation, it got a lot more focused. So my research looks at the relationship specifically between philanthropy now, poverty, and politics. And when I say politics, I mean like the day-to-day political interactions. I don't mean like government politics. In the social sciences, we sometimes refer to that as like big P politics or little P politics. Like, just
okay, yeah. So I have no background in that whatsoever. Yeah. So what would what's a day-to-day little P politics?
A little P politics. Good question.
Example.
So for instance, like trying to the way I describe it to people is anything that you feel like you would be willing to fight for or stake a claim for.
Okay.
Like, that could be something as small as, like, I want to have access to the internet, and if I don't, my provider, you know, hikes the rates by 5 times in the course of a day, and all of a sudden I can't afford that. That has become a political issue because it's something I feel like I would be willing to fight for, that I am owed, you know, I have a claim for. But, you know, it could also be gender and gender expression, sexual orientation, issues of race and access. Oftentimes, I think age is really interesting to think about with politics. Like, are young people taken seriously as political actors because they don't have access to voting? So what are the informal ways that they kind of, you know, act and enact politics in the world?
Okay. I think there's a saying in, like, big P politics that all politics is local. Is this kind of a distillation of that?
Kind of. Do you remember in, like, the 80s and kind of in the feminist movement, 70s and 80s, there was a phrase that, like, the personal is political?
No, I've actually never heard that.
Oh, yeah. So this was big in kind of the second wave feminist movement, that the personal is political. So scaling up things that happen in the home that historically had been, like, personal and private, and recognizing that actually that is deeply political terrain because it impacts our lives 100%.
Okay, so the government's not all taxes and lighthouses. Now we're talking about regulation of, like you're saying, sexuality and gender. And that
stuff. Yeah, and day-to-day life, and just recognizing that, like, politics doesn't have to be synonymous with government. That politics to me are, yeah, the things that matter, how we form our identity, what we feel like we'd be willing to fight for.
Okay, so what would the methodology then be for looking at something like this? How do you actually go about trying to figure out what these relationships are and within communities?
So I do qualitative research, which can look a million different ways. Qualitative research is just really, really a broad umbrella term. But for me, I do kind of a combination of ethnography and participant observation, and then semi-structured interviews.
Okay.
So I'll back up. So my dissertation is specifically then looking at one particular model of philanthropy called social justice philanthropy. That's really kind of the most radical, like, left self-described, like, the most radical form of philanthropy that exists. So people that practice social justice philanthropy recognize that they're kind of, like, on the margins of philanthropy as a whole. So because of that, one of the things I'm trying to ascertain...
So let's put a quick pin. What actually is social justice philanthropy then? What does that look like?
Yeah, so it can take many forms, but the what I'm finding that is kind of the... Oh, what's the word? Like, the undercurrent that ties everything together is both a commitment to democratize who are the philanthropists.
Okay.
So instead of saying that philanthropy is for people with a lot of money, saying everyone can be a philanthropist, and then it's actually a lot more democratic because we are broadening who gets to participate, not just based on wealth, but based on politics and your own personal politics and values.
So that's really interesting. That's actually something we'll touch on a little bit later on in our conversation. Great. Okay, all right. So we've got the definition of the social justice side of things down.
So that's one part. The second part is oftentimes social justice philanthropists are interested in funding grassroots organizations that have a hard time appealing to large foundations. So one way of saying that is that it's trying to fund the underdogs, like trying to fund groups that are doing pretty radical work, are really trying to shift power and change the status quo rather than provide services. Services are really important, obviously, but it's much easier to fund services because you can write a grant that says, if you give us this amount of money, we can turn around and do XYZ.
Yeah.
And it's much easier to measure that. Whereas with, like, social movements and funding things that take a lot longer, there's, like, no metric. You know,
it's very hard to define an endpoint of, like, the end of racism. There's no
exactly. And I think, you know, like, the Black Lives Matter movement is a really good example of this, which is, like, it is really difficult to apply for a grant for a movement that has many moving parts and many different targets. So social justice philanthropists tend to put a lot of faith in organizations that don't have, like, a distilled service element. And then I guess the last part is that they're actually trying a lot of social justice philanthropy organizations are really trying to change the way philanthropy happens. Also, so getting their donors not only to think of themselves as philanthropists regardless of how much they give, but also saying, oh, now that you've done this, you're actually an active agent in, like, changing the way that, you know, you're buying into a way that changes what philanthropy means for everybody.
So I was reading a paper on that exact thing about how organizations interact with their donors afterwards and trying to figure out, you know, just looking at the phrasing, certain words that they would use, reflecting back on the donors, like thank you notes, that kind of stuff, and immediate feedback that donors received increased repeat giving by an enormous amount. I think it was over like 40 or 50%, which I found astounding that, I guess I had always assumed that when a person gives, it was often internally motivated rather than being an external factor that promotes them doing it. And it seems like that's maybe not the case all the time.
It's definitely not the case all the time. People give for so many different reasons, but it's almost always selfish. You know, like it almost always comes back to the individual. Now, that doesn't have to be a bad thing. People might give because they realize that, like, I'm giving because this is going to help the world be a better place, but that's the world I live in and I'm going to benefit from that, you know? Or it might be, I want to give because I want my name on a building, which is also kind of selfish, you know? And so it's really different, but I think any type of giving, it is internally motivated by something somewhat selfish, but I don't think that's necessarily bad.
I'm trying to remember, there's a term for it, isn't there? It's like, it's self-interested altruism or...
Yeah, I think so.
Something like that. I can't remember exactly.
Yeah. You know, and it's interesting because a lot of people in my line of work, which is kind of critical social science, tend to actually heavily critique a lot of philanthropy because it's often like 75% of philanthropy is given to colleges, hospitals, and museums.
Yes.
At least in the US, which, you know, one could argue that those are not really actually like that those institutions have value, but they have the most value for middle and upper middle class Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And that they are not really doing a lot to like change the way that the US operates or the way that people actually have access. It's just kind of like, those are institutions of the status quo. So
it's sort of just, people have this as a idea in their mind of what philanthropy is. It kind of keeps giving and they don't, is it a perception problem? People may not actually know where else they can give money.
Totally. Yeah, especially, I mean, think about families where, like, maybe you have a family foundation and people in your family have given for years, and if you all went to the same university, then of course you give. I'm not saying that's bad, it's just that if 75% of all of the philanthropic dollars in the U.S. from individuals go to those three types of institutions, like, that's a lot of money that's not going towards trying to alleviate economic inequality or trying to, you know, actually, like, reform the education system.
And that's quite a bit, because I was looking at a couple of numbers that were put out that I think it's personal giving makes up more than 70% of donated dollars in the U.S.
Yeah.
So 70% of that is going, you're seeing greater than 50% of all the donated money is going towards these very specific causes.
Exactly, yeah. And then, I mean, philanthropy in the U.S. is a $330 billion industry, which is crazy. That's so much money, you know, and so I guess part of the reason I got interested in it from an academic standpoint was also then like that. I mean, people usually just assume that philanthropy equals good.
Yes.
You know, and that is a shit ton of money that is, in my mind, was like not really being interrogated adequately because it just fell under this banner of like being quote unquote good. And to me, it's like, well, what else is happening along the way? What happens to donors? What's the relationship between donors and recipients? Are we just like perpetuating power relationships between like wealthy benefactors that seem to know best because they have money? Are there other models out there? Are there other ways of doing this that are trying to, you know, be more inventive and more innovative? And I'm finding that there are. There's some really, really interesting non-traditional models that I think are quite hopeful.
So when you're examining this and you're going out and doing interviews, are you going and talking to donating organizations, so these nonprofits themselves, to try to get a sense about what their model is, or are you talking to donors, or are you talking to the recipients, or everybody?
Yes.
Okay.
All. So I'm doing kind of a nested case study where I'm working with one organization in Seattle where I live pretty closely, and they are kind of the leaders of social justice philanthropy in the U.S. right now.
Okay.
So I feel pretty lucky. So that's Social Justice Fund, who you mentioned.
All right.
And they've been incredibly gracious to let me in. I'm already a member of the organization, so I had a lot of trust and rapport. Obviously, that raises questions about my, you know, bias towards them. And so I'm trying to be incredibly careful of that as I look at my data and talk to people. But one of the things we talk about a lot in the social sciences is this idea of like being an insider or an outsider.
Mm-hmm.
And that if you're an insider, it's harder to see the criticisms and harder to be critical, but it's also a lot easier to gain access and easier to build trust.
Yeah.
And so as an outsider, I might be less biased, but I would definitely not have the same level of access, nor would I actually be able to understand a lot of what people were telling me in interviews. You know, like there's kind of a code and a language of how people do this work that I wouldn't understand if I hadn't done it myself.
You know, there are just certain fields where you have to be willing to let impartial observation kind of go out the door sometimes. So.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, depending on, well, you and I have talked about this, but like, there's something to be said about questioning whether objectivity is possible ever. And I would say it's not. And maybe that's not for this science bedtime story, but...
I have firm feelings occasionally about CO2 measurements I make, so I don't believe that I'm able to be incredibly objective either all the time, so.
Yeah.
I used to talk to the algae that I cultured.
Yeah, totally.
It happens.
Of course, and we all have attachments to the work that we do based on who we are and our lives and our families. And I'll just refer you and anyone listening to Donna Haraway on this one, because I think she has a really good understanding of situated knowledge and partial, you know, impartial, and trying to do the best with objectivity.
All right. So aside from the Social Justice Fund, are there any large organizations, philanthropic organizations that you feel particularly excited about, that you think are doing good work right now?
Yeah, so they are definitely, Social Justice Fund is like the leader. Oh, and I didn't really answer your question before, actually. So because I have kind of this, I'm an insider with this organization, it's opened up access to, I've interviewed about 30 donors and, or 25 donors, some who've done multiple involvement, you know, many years of involvement, some who just did 1 year of involvement, and staff and board members. And then also I've spent time with two different grantee organizations who have been longtime recipients of grants from this organization.
Okay.
So kind of running the gamut, and then a lot of participant observation, going to a lot of events, doing the fundraising myself, understanding what that feels like, and then a lot of kind of archival research that is helping me also see how an organization like Social Justice Fund is connected to other social justice philanthropic institutions. So that's actually ends up being a great segue to your other question. Because there are, I would say on the East Coast, the North Star Fund in New York is doing really interesting work. In Chicago, the Crossroads Foundation is doing really interesting work. Those are the two that come to mind that I'm really excited about. Yeah, there's a foundation in Minnesota that has roots with Paul Wellstone, the progressive politician. So I don't remember what that's... I think it's maybe like the Wilder Foundation or something. Anyway, they are trying the Social Justice Fund model. They actually had the executive director go out and train them on how to do it. So I didn't know that when I started working with them, but it's actually pretty neat because it's showing that, like, while I'm researching it from this academic standpoint, there's already case studies of this model developing all over the country because other cities are going to try it.
So it sounds like we're at a moment where there's maybe a movement towards a new type of model. Do you think this is going to be sort of the way of the future, or do you see a different future for philanthropy going forward?
Yeah, thank you. I think we're at a turning point, and I say that for a lot of reasons. I mean, you've seen just the rise of crowdfunding online too, and the fact that there's these like dispersed funding platforms that do incredibly well. Not all of them do well, but I think people really like to know that they can make a difference, even if it's $25. And that because of, you know, digital platforms and the fact that people can make a video and really like develop an empathic connection with the viewer of that video, that it's not just some door knocker coming to your door canvassing and asking for $20, you know, or someone outside of the grocery store. Like, I especially think that our generation has, like, no patience for that stuff. It just feels too impersonal. It's really invasive. Like, I just don't even understand why anyone would sign up to do that type of work. It just seems awful. And everything that I've learned about fundraising suggests that that's, like, the worst way.
It doesn't seem that helpful. I've known a couple of people that did canvassing in college, and they had nothing but the worst things in the world to say about it. Just ineffective, people were mean, everyone hated
people
it.
People are so mean. People are so mean. And they don't even see you as a real human. It's like, ugh, get out of my face.
I mean, you get lumped into the same thing as, like, door-to-door vacuum salesmen and other con artists. So it's, you're not putting yourself in a position to win, I think.
No. I am all for door-to-door community organizing, especially around political campaigns. I think that can actually be incredibly effective. But asking for money, no. No.
Yeah.
So that being said, you're seeing campaigns that ask for the same size of contribution and are arguably the same level of impersonal because it's online, being far more successful. And I think part of that is the idea of offering incentives. I think part of it is the idea
yes.
of being part of a community. People like to feel like they are, you know, joining forces with other folks that are intentionally opting in to contribute to something that speaks to them. And I also think that this is gaining a lot of steam since the recession, because I think especially for millennials, we're realizing that, like, we may never accrue enough where, like, we're going to be able to do our giving later on in life. You know, it's not going to work to just wait. If we want to do it, we need to figure out a way to incorporate that now, even though we might not be making as much money as we thought we would. But I think a lot of us realize this myth of, like, saving up and then, you know, doing our philanthropy later in life is, like, not going to happen.
Yeah, I think we might be out of luck on that one. We'll be happy.
We are out of luck, yeah.
And Social Security is running out in, what, like 2034, so...
Yeah, so we're screwed. So, but I think also, you know, to what I said earlier about some people, like, philanthropy always being somewhat self-interested, I think a lot of us also, and when I say us, I mean millennials, really,
yeah.
particularly educated millennials, I think are realizing that, oh, these institutions that we were promised would serve us are not going to serve us in the way we were told. We are realizing that, like, the level of inequality in our country is exorbitant and makes us look like a country of the global south, comparatively. You know, we realize, I think, that 75% of our total GDP is what we owe in debt as a country, and that's pretty horrific, you know? Like, we say we have the highest GDP, but 75% of it is tied up to debt. So I think a lot of us are realizing, oh, this world needs to change. And I can have a vested interest in doing that. Or even if it's not interested in, like, really radical change, I think the reason a lot of online campaigns are doing so well is that we see people innovating and we see people being really excited about doing their little part to make the world either a little more efficient or mm-hmm. a little more exciting or just work a little bit better or help a few more people. And I think that really speaks to a lot of folks, because otherwise when we look around, it's, like, pretty dismal.
It's both a hopeful and a depressing note to end on, so...
Welcome to my life, Brandon. It's, like, constantly oscillating between really hopeful and, like, ah, fuck, this is really bad.
I work in climate change, so yeah. I'm right on board with you there between, like, I wonder if I can make a difference, and this is a lot of nonsense.
Yeah, yeah. Apparently there is a growing field of psychology that is specifically looking at the psychology of climate change deniers
mm-hmm.
and the psychology of climate change activists, the long-term impacts of having to constantly, like, confront this doomsday feeling and somehow find the motivation to keep going. And it's pretty messed up.
It certainly is. And this will be a topic for another one of these. But
you should totally interview someone who's doing climate change psychology.
It's because at least for me personally, it's gotten bad enough that I'm leaving the field. So
right,
yeah,
right. Which is tragic because we need people like you. You know, like, and I think part of what motivates a lot of that research actually on climate change psychology is, like, we need to figure out what's happening so that people don't burn out. Because as it is right now, we have, like, a 5 to 7 year window where people have all of this energy, but then it's too hard. It's like schizophrenia to go back and forth between like, yeah, we can change, and like, oh my fucking God, there's no hope.
Yeah, I put in my 7 years, and
there you go. Yeah, I'm out. You've put in your 7 years. You're out.
I'm out.
Gonna go work for the man.
The man, or the government, or maybe I'll just go live under I-95. I haven't decided yet. We'll figure it out. It's gonna end one way or another. Well, this was a really interesting segue into some of what I want to talk to you about, because I didn't realize how close this is going to overlap. So the first thing I wanted to bring up was the top 10 grant-making foundations in the U.S.
Yes. Number one, Gates Foundation.
Number one, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, with total assets of $41 billion.
Yep.
Which is enormous.
It's crazy.
How well do you know the rest of that list, though?
Okay, this is top 10 in the U.S.?
Top 10 grant-making foundations in the U.S. by total value of assets.
Okay, I don't know if I'll get the order right, but I think I can.
Yeah, don't worry about the order, but just like trying to hit some of the big guys.
Ford, MacArthur, Carnegie.
Ford is number two. Mark Arthur is number 10.
Okay.
It's the lowest one in the top 10. Assets of $6.3 billion.
Billion. Yeah.
So they have quite a lot of money that they're kicking around.
Yeah.
See, like you're saying, there's the Ford Foundation. I'll just read off the top 10. Ford, the...
Wait, I want to keep guessing.
Oh, keep going. Keep going. Okay, I'm not cutting off yet if you got it.
Is Carnegie on there?
Carnegie is not in the top 10.
Oh, interesting. Okay, but Ford and MacArthur are. Vulcan?
Nope.
Wait, is this family foundations or just any foundation?
This is... a thing from, let's see if I can find the actual, from the foundationcenter.org.
Yeah.
This is their top funders list.
Yep. Casey Foundation?
I got some bad news. No.
Not on there? Fuck. I don't know my own field. Okay, Brandon, fill me in. Who's number 3 through 9?
So it goes Bill and Melinda Gates, Ford Foundation, the J. Paul Getty Trust. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation.
Oh, of course. They're so interesting. They do really interesting work around like community health and health stuff. They're all health things. Yeah.
Yes, yeah. Then you have the Hewlett Foundation.
Okay.
The Kellogg Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
The Lilly Endowment. The Packard Foundation.
Uh-huh.
And the Moore Foundation.
I've never heard of the Moore Foundation, but I've heard of all the others.
Yeah, so they do kind of a wide range of things.
Is it interesting that Hewlett and Packard are both on there, but not together?
Oh, I didn't even realize that. Oh, I should have looked up more where this actually came from. Yeah, because some of them come from very interesting places.
Yes.
Yeah, so like you're saying, MacArthur and Ford Foundation provide support for individuals that are trying to like address complex problems in their fields. Kellogg Foundation is geared towards children.
Mm-hmm.
The Getty Trust supports the arts.
Okay.
So these are the ones, like the really big guys that you hear about in terms of total assets. What I thought was interesting, though, is I looked up this list instead of by assets, by the total giving per year.
Mm-hmm.
Number one on that list, still Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. They gave $3.3 billion in 2012.
Yep.
Or 2013, sorry. The rest of the list, 9 through 10, 100% different.
Really?
And they all come from a very specific source.
Oh.
Do you have any idea what these organizations are?
Super PACs?
Nope. I'll give you one more guess. It has to do with a very, very large industry in the United States.
Tech?
Numbers 2 through 9 are all things called Patients Assistance Foundations. So Bill and Melinda Gates gave $3.2 billion.
Yeah.
Between numbers 2 through 9, all these patients' assistance programs gave $5.6 billion.
Total.
I'll read you some of the names of these. Bristol-Myers Squibb Patient Assistance Foundation. Johnson & Johnson Patient Assistance Foundation. Merck Patient Assistance Program. Genentech Access to Care Foundation. Pfizer Patient Assistance Foundation. GlaxoSmithKline Patient Access Program.
Wow.
And the Abbey Patient Assistance Foundation.
Is that data also from the Foundation Center?
Yes.
Okay.
All of these programs are spun off charities of pharmaceutical companies that donate medicine to poor and underprivileged people within the United States. And all those values are wholesale values of the medicine that they're giving away.
Wow.
I was blown away to see that this is where the majority of or single foundations are giving away their money. It's the largest section of wow. all charity in the United States.
I didn't know that, Brandon. So this is fascinating. One of the things that I think is so interesting about philanthropy is that, as you said, like 75% of all giving is individual giving.
Yes.
Of all dollars given. And so then there's like this, there's bequests, then there's foundations, and then there's like corporate social responsibility or like corporate campaigns and corporate mm-hmm. grants. And it's interesting to me that, like, I wonder if those, it sounds like those are part of the foundations.
Yeah, so these are spun off. They're separate from the actual corporations themselves. It's a right. separate foundation. I assume the company itself gets a massive tax break for donating all this medication to.
Right.
So I assume there's a large financial incentive.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's one of the reasons that studying philanthropy is so interesting. And talk about, like, it being self-motivated. Like, a lot of people are very strategic, and people that have a lot of wealth actually hire, like, philanthropic consultants to help them figure out the best way to give their money away so they can get the most tax breaks.
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah. So this is a real tangent, but one of my colleagues, her name is Sky Naisland. She's at the University of Washington, also in my cohort in geography. She studies parasites.
Okay.
And kind of the social geography of parasites. So she's a health geographer. And she's really interested in, depending on what place you live in the world and what region you live in, which parasites get the most attention.
Okay.
And thus, like, both how that influences what gets put in textbooks, how it's described in textbooks, and how research money flows to it, what the social discourse is on different parasites. It is fascinating. I've never thought about parasites so much. And one of the things that she showed is that in textbooks, there's a huge disparity between how textbook publishers, how they represent parasites that are often in the global south versus the global north.
Mm-hmm.
So parasites in the global south often, like, even just in the way that they're represented in the textbook, are shown as these, like, horrible, demonic, like, awful creatures that are, like, destroying entire populations. And very similar, you know, parasites that, like, have a very similar structure biologically, but that happen to be in countries like the US or Europe.
Where infrastructure is much more capable of handling it.
Also where we don't think of ourselves as sick places or as diseased places.
Yeah.
You know, they get, like, one little cutaway in the book of, like, and sometimes people get, you know, XYZ.
People still get leprosy in the United States, but nobody.
Right, and it might just show yeah. like the microbial makeup yep. of the parasite.
Whereas you're like, hey, look at this guy.
In, you know, Ghana or Togo or somewhere in sub-Saharan Africa, they'll show the person with the
yes
parasite, yeah. and then it's like, oh, look. So it's just really, you know, there's a geography to disease and health also, and so, like, how do they decide what drugs they're giving away and who gets to decide the priority of that and which populations are actually receiving them?
It's interesting at every single step along the way, because I haven't done work specifically with parasites per se, but if you go through the grant application process and the sciences in general, you'll often reach out to the funding agency beforehand and see mm-hmm. what they're interested in funding.
Yes.
So they'll tell you kind of how you need to tailor your application to get the money, so you get the selection process even before you've even applied. And yes. you may have an application that's very interesting, tackling a novel problem, but if that's not kind of on the agenda already, you may throw your application against the wall 2-3 years and just nothing will ever happen.
I mean, this is why I think philanthropy in general is so interesting, is that, like, there is a political economy to what gets funded. And it influences what research gets done. It influences what types of organizing and services get provided. It influences the way our hospitals run.
It's a big world out there, and lots of things happen.
That most people don't really think about.
Okay, so I wanted to talk to you a little bit about maybe the history of philanthropy well. Going back to the beginning and kind of seeing how it started in the U.S. and what's been going on to lead up to the point that we're at today.
Philanthropy.
The year is 1726. A 20-year-old Benjamin Franklin was returning to Philadelphia from 18 months abroad in London working as a typesetter in a printer's shop. Benjamin Franklin had been sent to London by the governor of Pennsylvania, William Keith, to get machinery needed to start another newspaper in Philadelphia, because apparently Philadelphia needed another newspaper. They already had like four at the time. That plan, however...
Be too educated.
Yeah, and they needed Ben Franklin publishing whatever his sassy stuff was, doing that. But this plan went completely tits up the minute that Ben Franklin got off the boat, as the governor who sent him over there did not bother to buy the printing press machinery before he sent Franklin. So Franklin just shows up, gets off the boat, they're like, we don't have anything for you, and he's like, what? So Franklin decides to spend that time partying, drinking, and just roaming around, seeing the lovely ladies of London, as he was wont to do. He returns to the colonies after some time there, a little dispirited, needing financial help to get his passage back. And during the trip, he laid out a list of the primary virtues that he thought that a person should exhibit in order to be morally perfect.
Okay.
These virtues, in no particular order, are temperance, eat not to dullness, drink not to elevation. He did not do very well in that one. He was a bit of a lush. Silence, speak not but what may benefit others or yourself. Avoid trifling conversation. He did not do well on this one either. I think he was a bit of a trifler. Order, let all your things have their place. Let each part of your business have its time. Okay, we'll give him a pass on that.
I've heard that one before.
Resolution, resolve to perform what you ought. Perform without fail what you resolve. Frugality, make no expense, but to do good to others or yourself, i.e. waste nothing. Industry, lose no time, be always employed in something useful, cut off all unnecessary actions. Sincerity, we'll skip a few. Justice, he was also not so big on this one since he tried to screw his best friend's wife while he was traveling one time.
That jerk.
Moderation, cleanliness, tranquility, chastity. Rarely use venery, but for health or offspring, never for dullness, weakness, or the injury of your own or another's peace or reputation. He was notorious for visiting prostitutes in France when he was the ambassador to France.
Yeah.
So he wasn't so good on that one. And humility. Imitate Jesus and Socrates. However, he later added a 14th virtue to this list. And that 14th virtue was charity, or love of one's fellow man. He came back to the States really firmly believing in this idea of charity, and he formed something called the Junto, or the Junto, I'm not sure, J-U-N-T-O. Have you ever heard of this?
I haven't.
So it was called the Junto, also known as the Leather Apron Club, and it was a group of 12 friends which met every Friday to discuss moral, political, and scientific topics with the purpose of self and community improvement. And Franklin wanted
a salon.
It was very much in that vein, with the difference being that they collected money to try to have a direct impact in the community. So it wasn't just for the sharing of ideas, but they actually raised money for the funding of various projects in Philadelphia during this time.
It sounds like a giving circle then.
Yeah, it was this very interesting thing. So over the 30 years that they were there, Franklin seemed to use this to, like, both generate and fund philanthropic ideas. They created the first subscription library in 1731. They created the fire brigade, along with fire insurance.
Okay.
They set up the foundation that would become the University of Pennsylvania in 1750.
Aww. Such good foresight, these men.
They nailed a lot of stuff. They made a hospital in 1752.
And women.
At that time, I have bad news. I do not think that the ladies were allowed into the
Junto. No, you said they nailed a lot of things. I said, and women.
Oh. Yep.
I was making a sex joke. Come on.
I don't think they were referred to as women at the time. They were called doxies.
Trollops. doxies? Women were called doxies?
Prostitutes were called doxies. Doxies?
Prostitutes, yeah.
Or ramblers. Maybe rumblers, I'm not sure. It's one of the two.
Okay, anyway, so they started a lot of institutions through their charity.
And they also had the first challenge grant, I think, in 1752 really? To start the hospital. It was a challenge grant that they would give money provided that enough other money was raised from the community.
The first ever challenge grant?
As far as I can tell. They also raised money for public road paving and the creation of a militia.
Mm.
So they did a lot of things
in
a pretty short period of time.
Yeah, how long were they doing it?
30 years.
Okay.
Which, that's a pretty solid resume for any 30-year institution to bang out that many things. I'd like to ask you a couple of the questions that they used to start off the Junto meetings.
Okay.
Elise, have you met with anything in the author you last read, remarkable or suitable to be communicated to the Junto, particularly in history, morality, poetry, physics, travel, mechanics, arts, or other parts of knowledge?
What a question. Yes, I have.
Okay. Would you care to share it with... No. Okay, here's another one, and you can give me a one-part answer to this.
Okay.
Do you know of any fellow citizen who has lately done a worthy action deserving praise and imitation, or who has committed an error proper for us to be warned against and avoid?
Ooh.
Who's hot, who's not?
Yes to the first. Do I know any scoundrels?
Yeah, who's being scurrilous these days?
Who is a scoundrel? Oh, yeah, I met a real weirdo at this wedding that I was just at. And he's from Houston, Brandon. Watch out.
I'd like to apologize on behalf of my Texan brethren.
His name is Nate. I won't give any other identifying features about him. Except that I felt very uncomfortable around this human.
Okay, so... Yeah, they were asking these questions, trying to put together ideas, and they used it to promote people in the area that they thought were doing good work. They would raise funds for that. But part of why I thought this was very interesting is that this became, or this kind of grew out of and promoted these things called voluntary associations that were present in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems like you've heard of those.
I have, but I would love to hear what you have dug up about them.
So as far as I can tell, these are these groups of sort of like-minded people working together towards a common cause, and it sounds very much like a case of everything old is new again, because this was very much about community and this idea that everyone can be involved in philanthropy, and that was the way that the U.S. operated in this area for a very long period of time, that it was about reaching out locally and with everybody involved to promote the welfare of as many people as possible.
Yes, I think the idea that everything old is new again is astute. I will keep in mind that the only people at that time that could own property were white men.
Yep.
And so the physical form might look similar in that it's a community effort to try and take care of the community. But who was considered community at that time, and who was worthy of making the decisions, and who was deserving to receive input or receive the outcomes?
Absolutely. So the direction may have changed, but the mechanism looks similar.
Yes, but I will point out that because of that disparity, because at that time that white men were the only ones able to own property, that a lot of the groups that I look at are specifically addressing the racial wealth gap today that grew out of that period.
Okay.
So, I think it is interesting that, like, the ethic of kind of community-oriented giving and giving with other people is back. And even more interesting to me that one of the real things that people are trying to do with that model now is address the centuries-old inequalities that stemmed from that time period.
So, yes, the inequality is very much wrapped up within the system at the time and helped actually dictate what philanthropy looked at.
Yep.
or looked like at that time. So Alexis de Tocqueville, who was a guy that was going around the U.S. kind of looking at things, he wrote a book called Democracy in America after his tours in the U.S. in the 1830s.
Very influential book.
Very, very influential book. But one of the things he wrote about were all these voluntary associations. Mm-hmm. And he made the observation that the wealthy elite in the U.S., since they were relatively less powerful than their European counterparts mm-hmm. due to the democratic nature of the U.S., mm-hmm. were often creating charities to promote very specific agendas and viewpoints, mm-hmm. kind of like the way you're talking about the hospitals, museums, newspapers, that mm-hmm. kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. Those would often be kind of wrapped within a charitable umbrella, and that a lot of these voluntary associations were created by less wealthy people, more of the common people, as a means of kind of combating the large conglomerated wealth of the elites in the U.S. Mm-hmm. So you kind of had mm-hmm. these two forces that were pushing against each other, one trying to maintain its control from the top down, and the other one using its very distributed nature to raise enough funds to enforce their own agendas. That's where you end up developing a lot of like political machines and that kind of stuff stemmed out of voluntary associations that were targeting like immigrants coming to the U.S.
Right.
So you'd have some of those put together and they would use that to push their own individual agendas.
It sounds like they were very influenced also by the Enlightenment, like the individual beliefs of learning and exploration and democracy and all of that.
I would love to go back and hang out in a room and see what some of these people were talking about to mm-hmm. figure out how that motivation looked at that point in time. Mm-hmm. What's really driving the desires? How much of it's a front? How much of it is completely real? I'd like to see it in like kind of rural versus urban areas.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
Because it seems like it's all over the place. Like it's so hard to pin down exactly what they mean. Because I was looking at some of the lists and, you know, they address anything and everything. They're just hundreds of these things littered across the U.S. It seems to be just a very common part of being alive in the 1800s is, oh, you're part of a voluntary association.
Right,
like,
right.
What's yours doing?
Yeah. Whereas, I mean, similarly now, like, 85% of U.S. households make a charitable contribution during the year. It seems like it's kind of part and parcel of just what it means to be American is that it's assumed that you give.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely seems to be kind of woven into the fabric of who we are and what we are. Mm-hmm. It's certainly something that, you know... Mm-hmm.
That's giving me some inspiration to go see if I can find any archival records of voluntary association, like meeting notes or anything from them.
Yeah, that'd be pretty cool. Mm-hmm. I'm sure they have those. They have to have, like, one person taking minutes in the corner, scribbling away furiously. Talking about the archival research actually kind of segues nicely into the next bit, which is the way that the wealthy portion of the U.S. tried to actually break some of this stalemate was in a very particular manner.
Okay.
So this is 1869.
Okay.
One Charles W. Eliot, coincidentally T.S. Eliot's cousin, becomes the president of a provincial college of no particular importance in Boston named Harvard. Not a lot was going on. It's just a place where you would send your kids off to go learn Greek and dabble in alchemy and whatever it is that people did in college during those days. And he had this very particular set of ideas that college should not just be a place for the intellectually gifted to sit down and translate Ovid. It should be a place for the development and furtherance of statecraft and science and all the work in the fields that you had professors in. Mm-hmm. And he was foundational in creating the first research university, dedicated research university.
Thanks, CW.
And as soon as he floated this idea, the wealthy in the U.S. were like, yes, finally, and started dumping a ton of money into this idea. Because now, rather than having idle rich, the idea was send your wealthy scions off to Harvard, have them train further in statecraft, and have this be a source of like cultural cachet that can then be turned into political cachet as they enter work within the government.
Yeah.
So within the next couple of years, aside from Harvard, people started dumping tons of cash into creating a lot of other private research universities as well. Mm-hmm. Cornell in 1865, Johns Hopkins in 1876, Stanford 1891, and the University of Chicago in 1891 as well. Mm. And these were all places where you had very large, wealthy, single or a couple of benefactors putting the money in to start something that they wanted on their agenda. Let's see. I have a quote here I want to read from a person named Peter Hall. He had a book chapter talking about philanthropy in the U.S., and he talks about this period of time. Quote, in the closing, you know, it's one of those weird things with Google Books where they'll pull chapters out.
Oh, yeah.
And then they won't actually tell you what the book is or what it is. So I'm going to put the link to the PDF in the iTunes runner so people can look at it. From there, quote, in the closing years of the 19th century, higher education institutions became embedded in an increasingly dense and complex network of organizations, including business corporations, charitable and cultural institutions dependent on them for technology and expertise, professional and scholarly societies, and book and periodical publishers that disseminated the scholarship of their faculties, and trade associations and groups advocating social and economic reform that translated scholarship into policy. So it was very much about converting colleges and universities into machinery almost of a kind. Like it wasn't, it was no longer strictly about knowledge and education, it was about practical applications. And another weird thing, in 1899, it turns out that Yale was governed by the New York Railroad and the Standard Oil Company.
Huh.
People with money were able to push that far that they could actually just straight up control the presidency of some of these universities.
Well, so, that's, I mean, we see that now, too. I mean, you get really wealthy people from companies on the board of trustees of colleges and...
Absolutely. That's... That's one of the things, apparently, was you'd get lots and lots of members on boards of basically everything, all these charitable institutions, and you'd kind of hone the direction that they all faced to be one that worked for what you were aiming to. You can promote kind of your own ideas. So that's us. We work in academia, and it came out of this weird war between the upper class and the common man about how to develop charitable institutions. That's...
Tie it all together there. I see what you did, Brandon.
That's our academic background.
Yeah.
They have us on the payroll. Thanks, Ben Franklin.
Thanks, Ben Franklin and C.W.
Wright?
No.
Elliot. Charles Elliot. Sorry.
C.W. Elliot. Well, and it's so... Yeah, it's a really interesting relationship because it not only was about, like, reproducing an elite social class, it's also then... where knowledge was being made and where knowledge was coming from and dictating the values around knowledge production in the U.S. And I think what's so interesting right now is like the rhetoric, especially from a lot of conservative Republicans about, you know, gut the liberal arts, we just need things to be effective and job creating and whatever. And what I heard in that quote that you just shared is like, there was actually at that point a shift towards things that were really pragmatic.
Very much so. Yeah, it was about trying to figure out how to rework some of these universities to address kind of apparent physical problems often. Learn how to do statecraft. Learn how to operate machinery and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Create
the tools.
It's still
very job-oriented.
Yes.
But we think, and yet these were the very elite institutions that were definitely not like vocational schools.
No, yeah, not,
so that's
not vocational schools. It was about... Yeah. But I guess some of it was about setting the research agenda as well, so you can try to figure out where the next steps would end up being.
Yes. I just think, I guess what I'm saying is that often the response against this critique about, or the like Republican criticism of higher education, the response I hear to that is like, it's central to who we are as a country, like liberal arts is part, you know, part of what our founding fathers were all about is this kind of broad set of knowledge. And what I'm hearing you say is actually there was this move, a very similar, again, like history repeating itself, where the elites were like, well, yeah, but also we want to guarantee that we can, you know, I mean, that's social reproduction of the upper class.
Well, if you want further weird history repeating itself, it's around this time that Andrew Carnegie was setting up his philanthropic institution. So Andrew Carnegie was by far the wealthiest American in the U.S. He had a I think he had close to $1 billion in the 1800s.
Billion T. Unheard of in that time.
Absolutely unheard of at that time. Would still put him on like the top 100 richest people in the world or something now, whatever.
Yeah.
And he was huge on giving away his money.
Okay.
He set up very large institutions, started like Carnegie Mellon. But one of the other things that he was big on was making sure that other millionaires at the time were also giving away their money.
Mm-hmm.
So he started pressing other people to give away the vast majority of their fortune towards philanthropic institutions at the ends of their lives, which is bizarrely similar.
The original Warren Buffett.
He was the original Warren Buffett, and it looks so similar to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation right now. He actually was proposing that Congress, if people who were millionaires failed to give away a certain amount of their money, he wanted Congress to institute mandatory estate confiscation and redistribute private fortunes.
Yeah.
So he was very much about trying to even out some of that huge income inequality that was present at the time. So that also I found very astounding. So I guess I assume that kind of movement was extremely modern, and here we have it in 1899.
Yeah. Well, I mean, people know that, like, economic inequality is not good for the democracy. Like, it doesn't work for a democracy. Interestingly, like, I would encourage anyone listening or you to, like, look at the difference between philanthropy in the U.S. and Europe.
Like, okay. Philanthropy I don't know anything about it.
Yeah,
does it not exist really over there?
Like, people, there is no philanthropy in Europe because they have such strong
social welfare securities. States. Okay.
But in the Netherlands, where I was last year, and you know, in my intro said I do love Amsterdam, and that's true. Some families there, the average is like 70% of their income goes to taxes, but everyone then is protected. So then there's no like additional philanthropy.
you're already doing the mandatory philanthropy. It's interesting though that you can't, if there's no actual philanthropy going on from the citizens directly, it seems hard to take a barometer about what they care about or what they would support directly.
Well, it ends up happening through the political system because they have a much more diverse, they have like 10 political parties.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
Yeah, so people express it that way. And then you get these interesting coalition governments. So that's one thing that occurred to me. The other was earlier you asked if there were like foundations that I was excited about right now that were doing interesting work.
Yeah.
And I listed some very tiny ones in big cities in the U.S., but one big one that I'll point out is the Soros Foundation, George Soros, S-O-R-O-S. Okay. And he's known for like really trumpeting like economic quality or, you know, working against economic inequality. And he gave a huge amount of money to like anti-police brutality organizing that was happening after Michael Brown was murdered last year. And
okay.
So he's a pretty interesting guy who's a very wealthy individual who I think is doing pretty interesting stuff with his personal fortune.
So I just wanted to say one last thing about Andrew Carnegie is after his initial set of donations where he set up basically it was like libraries, churches, parks, museums, and universities, he actually started working with some of the other people who are donating money and developed the first set of grant-making foundations as opposed to doing direct support on his end so that people could donate their money to a large pool, and then that pool, which would be overseen by people, would then distribute it out over, you know, in perpetuity rather than just having $5 million you give to one museum once. So kick that thing off right around the turn of the 19th century.
Thanks, Andrew Carnegie, for our modern-day foundations.
He's the most fascinating person that I saw in all the stuff that I was looking up. He seemed to be kind of the turning point towards the modern era in a lot of things that I saw.
Yeah. Or, I mean, he's the biggest turning point of the people that got a lot of coverage.
Yes.
And that had the most money, because he had the most money. So it's easy to then also be the most influential.
It turns out when you can pave the streets in gold that people are willing to drive along that road with you.
Oh, that's all it takes? Uh-huh. Thanks for letting me know. Thank you.
Yeah, so once we have our first $1 billion, we can start really getting some change done.
How about gold spray paint? Do you think people will come along with me with gold spray paint?
Turns out if you can fool them, it works just as well.
Great. All right. I've got my next plan for world domination then.
Thank you so much, Elise. This was
This was so fun. I'm like just delighted that you spent some time researching some stuff about philanthropy, too. Well, thanks for doing this series. It's really neat to get to talk and learn.
Yeah, I'm loving getting to chat with people and hear about some stuff that I don't do that frequently, so... Oh, if you have any last plugs?
Oh!
A paper coming out people could go read?
Well, so my website is just my name, elisegordon.com, and if anyone wants to know more about some of the stuff I do, they can find me there.
Give it a look.
But I will say, I think that asking questions about how and why we give is something that I wish more young people talked about together. Maybe it would be interesting for people to organize their own junto.
Ah.
Just a one-time, a little giving salon.
You know, that's actually a really good idea, putting together a little giving salon. You know, it doesn't have to meet weekly for 30 years, as Franklin's did,
no,
but...
maybe just one time.
Yeah, bang it out once.
Tell everyone to plan to bring, you know, a meaningful amount to them and a discussion topic. Ask if there's any scoundrels in their life they need to be warned against. And and then decide together how they want to give.
All right, that's very, very solid advice. So, Elise, thank you so much, and
thanks,
glad
Brandon.
To have you on.
Yeah, me too. Take care.
Bob Cratchit?
Yes, Mr. Scrooge?
Who is this?
It's Mr. Applegate, sir. He's here to speak to you about his mortgage.
Please, Mr. Scrooge, I know you're very angry about this, and I didn't mean to fall behind in the payments. Lord knows it, being Christmas and all. Oh, please don't shout at me, sir. That and, of course, little Gwen. Her lungs aren't right. The doctor takes his share, don't he? I mean, you can yell and scream, and you're right, but it won't do no good, because I'm the stone you can't squeeze blood from, and that's the truth! Thank you for not shouting at me.
And the last thing we need to do is count down together from three. That way I can sync up the audio later.
Okay.
You ready?
Yeah.
Three, two, one. That was terrible. Let's try it again.
That was terrible?
Let's do 3, 2, 1 and then count down 3, 2, 1. You ready? We'll just do it back to back. All right. 3, 2, 1. 3, 2, 1. Oh, God.
What
you know what? Close
wrong?
Enough.
What am I doing
we
wrong?
Nailed it.